by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest this evening. And she's written extensively over some other articles, and now she has a book out that was released recently, and then she's planning another book also, and it's about Oklahoma. And it's a tragedy that we've got to revisit and try to get down to the bottom of. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Wendy Painting. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I'll tell you what, tell our listening audience a little bit about your background first, and then we'll get into your book.
Okay, well, I, as a student, it's actually funny, I was pursuing a bachelor's in literature, but I just had started taking an interest in the OKC case, and I went through everything I could read publicly, and then about 2007, it wasn't enough, I just had to go out there. And I did, to Oklahoma City. I needed to see this for myself. And during that trip, Stephen Jones, Timothy McVeigh's, former defense attorney, told me that he had placed all of the defense archives at the University of Texas in Austin, actually. And then for the next, 5 years, I was in there extensively, and I believe at this point I'm the only person to have gone through the entire available collection. And then I would follow that up with searching out people's names and that I would find in these documents, and I would go interview them and talk to them to the best that I could. I mean, there was a lot. So my research ended up being pretty extensive. And I wrote my PhD dissertation. I ended up obviously switching my focus and my studies and pursued a PhD. And the first book, Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh, is based on that dissertation. And that's based on a lot of stuff in the Jones archives, as well as some of the interviews I did. And then the second book I'm writing, which is called Redacted right now, that deals with the PatCon operation that I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. PatCon, this was a multi-agency national kind of undercover intelligence, counterintelligence operation that was being run around through the time of Ruby Ridge, through Waco, and then through Oklahoma City.
Right. This has really upset the people in America, has it not? Some of the real patriots are owned to this. I mean, they've got a pretty good understanding. And, your books and writing are helping flesh out some of the other hidden things, connections. What would you say, what was some of the goals, you think, in this Oklahoma bombing?
Well, certainly there was a need after the incidents at Ruby Ridge and Waco to kind of show that the Department of Justice was, doing something useful and was preventing what they were saying, were violent groups. And so one of the outcomes, anyways, was a discrediting of the Patriot Movement, but also a justification for larger budgets and changes in legislation, because, of course, after Oklahoma City, there's the Omnibus Counterterrorist Act, which is the precursor to the Patriot Act. They were trying to push that through. Clinton's administration and the Republicans were stopping them, but immediately after the bombing, that legislation was passed. I mean, immediately.
According to you're young. Go ahead.
If I could think of some of the biggest goals, it would be that those justification of budgets and legislation.
Right. What the people involved in this, when you're saying a multiple agency type of operation, what and what number and who would they be that were involved in this and the overall execution of this?
Well, that kind of involved the FBI. It involved the ATF, the Department of Defense, namely through, like, the National Guard. And those are the main agencies involved in PacCon, and there's been some others. But, you know, it was headed by the FBI, although it was working with other agencies. In the operation.
Right. When they seem to point to only with this bomb out in the truck, were there indications early on that there were multiple bombs inside the building that did not detonate? Tell us about that.
Yeah, very much so. There were reports immediately after. I mean, scores of them where, you know, we've gone in and we're disarming another bomb and they found another bomb. But there was a lot of media reports to that effect. Studies by people like General, a man named General Parton, who was an Air Force general. He put out some scientific studies about the, you know, the implausibility that the Ryder truck had caused the damage that it caused. Now, explosives isn't necessarily it's not my area of expertise, although, you know, I do know that there were multiple reports of multiple bombs found in the building, and that a lot of that is covered in detail in the documentary Noble Lie. It really goes into some of the reports of the other bombs.
Right. What was your part in Noble Lie? Did you contribute to some of the research on that?
Well, yes, I contributed to most of the research, and my co-writer Colin and the Neuenhaus, he also researched with me, and then we both wrote it. We basically wrote the entire documentary, but he really, because he has a military background, he handles the explosives, where I was able to handle kind of the historical, witnesses and eyewitness reports and, so that was kind of my end of it, and he was able to handle the more scientific, technical elements of the case.
The multiple bombs that there's evidence of that did not detonate would give credence to your assertions that there was more than just a couple of people like McVeigh and his cohorts there that pulled this off.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's really good, good evidence there in your books and so forth. Getting over to Timothy McVeigh, who was he really working for? What kind of indication do you have as to what he was up to or who he worked for?
Well, you know, I don't have a piece of paper saying that Timothy McVeigh worked for this person or that person, but what I am able to do is through piecing together all of his military records, and the statements that he made privately to his family and to his defense team, he claimed that he was inducted by the military, and this would go along with simultaneously what was going on with PatCon. Now, later, a few years back, Terry Nichols came out and said that McVeigh claimed to him he was working for the FBI. I've not seen documentation to that effect, but it's a very complex situation in that while the FBI was handling PatCon and was in charge of PatCon, there are other agencies working with them, and the Department of Defense being one of them.
There was some evidence by Bill Bean of a video of supposedly McVeigh coming out of the back of an APC.
Yes.
Did that have some relevance to him being connected to the service long before he said he was separated?
I'm familiar with the building footage and the studies. Yeah, that goes along exactly with it, because what I do know is that he had access to military bases after he supposedly separated from the Army. The other thing is that he leaves active duty Army and he returns to his home near Buffalo, New York, and he was in the National Guard there, where he's in the National Guard, this is funny, as PATCON is being run, which is, again, a multi-agency domestic intelligence operation, but another operation that was being run in the Buffalo Niagara Falls area was being staged out of there, very similar to PATCON, but that was utilizing mainly the National Guard, and he is... he made some claims that he was connected to that, and the paperwork, really his paper trail, puts him actually working in the office where this Project North Star was being staged out of at the time. I'm not trying to confuse the issue here, but what ends up that we're dealing with Timothy McVeigh is not only PATCON, but also this other operation called North Star.
Right. There were assertions early on that just that ammonium nitrate fertilizer bomb in that truck couldn't have cut some of those columns. Is this basically what you've uncovered in some of your research, or what?
Yes, that is my understanding of it. Again, I didn't focus on the technicalities of the bomb so much as McVeigh's paper trail and these admissions that he made privately. You know, and what you see is that he had been claiming to his family before the bombing even happened that he had been inducted into this operation, and he continued to claim that in private even after his arrest, to the point where he told some of his attorneys up until his dying day that he did not even believe he was actually going to be executed, that they were going to swoop him up and reward him for a job well done and take this execution. Now, whether that's true or not, that is what he claimed right up until the end. In private, because everybody knows the story of Timothy McVeigh taking credit for all of this, that was the public legacy that he put forth. That is not the types of claims he always made in private.
Right. There, just to give you some background here in Texas, what happened, we've been on this ever since it happened. And this occurred on April 19th, 1995, and that was 2 years after the Waco. Well, a year after the Waco, on the date of April 19th, 1994, we were in front of the Alamo with a Texas militia rally. So it looks like one of the goals was to undercut the building militia, that were being organized across America.
Well, very much so, and especially in Texas, in Austin, that was one of the main objectives of PATCON. In fact, that was its first target, where the what were called militia groups and patriot groups in Texas. That was the first target for this operation. And there's evidence to show that McVeigh actually, he goes through Texas, and I don't know, there's an attorney named Jesse Trentadue who's done a lot to uncover a lot of this information. He's continuously in suits with federal government lawsuits over a lot of the information, and one of the things he's recently uncovered was one of the main informants for PATCON, a man named John Matthews, actually claimed that he was at a training base in Texas with McVeigh and Anders Strassmeyer, who came out of the Elohim City element of the story. And so yeah, Texas is a big part of this.
Right. The Elohim City connection to the Oklahoma bombing, what can you tell us about that? How did it figure in?
Well, that was a white separatist community on the Oklahoma-Arkansas border, who they called it actually in private Alphabet City because of the scores of federal informants and agents that were embedded in this community, including the head of the community himself, who was an FBI informant, and feeding speeding tickets, motel records, and just some of McVeigh's other movements all put him at Elohim City at very critical times when the plot's developing. And the implication of that, what that means, is that he was working with other people, and that there were informants who had been reporting to their handlers prior to the bombing that there would be a bombing on April 19th in Oklahoma City. And so there were, you know, there was definitely foreknowledge of this plot, and part of it was information coming out of Elohim City.
Right. The name Jolly West, I believe he met with McVeigh before he was executed.
Well, that is,
but
that
also,
is one of the...
Jolly West is quite a mysterious character, is he not?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. It's very intriguing, very, very creepy. And my book, actually, Aberration, the first book that's going to be coming out in a couple months, that goes way into depth on Dr. Jolly West's past. It goes very in depth into who was Dr. Jolly West, and you know, I reviewed a lot of the papers he wrote. What's interesting is that while there's no paper trail to show that West met with McVeigh in prison, now maybe he did, maybe he didn't, the defense team definitely was in communication with him. What he did, West recommended his student, a man named Dr. John Smith, who had studied under him. This guy's an expert in hypnosis and all the same things that West was an expert in. It was West's student, his student, and he begins to see McVeigh in prison on a regular basis.
There seems to be, there's writings over the years that Jolly West met with Jack Ruby and Sirhan Sirhan.
Yes, he did.
Have you heard the same or researched any evidence to that?
Yes, I have. And I had a hard time finding information. I know that West met with Sirhan, but there wasn't a lot of information. There was some obscure information about his meetings with Jack Ruby. In fact, Ruby ended up deciding, you know, West met with Ruby right before Ruby came down with cancer, and so there is a connection there. The book does go into that. So that's what Patty Hearst is another one that West was involved with. And his
right.
whole career, he gained his prominence. He began his career through studying prisoners of war and brainwashing conditions in the Korean War, and he goes on to then study cults, so-called cults. He goes on to study political dissidents. In fact, he was at Waco. He was called in at Waco to consult on that case. West has a very long and extensive career, mainly dealing with psychological operations and brainwashing.
I think he worked out of UCLA, if I remember that right.
He worked at University of Oklahoma. They actually have a building named after him.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, but he overdosed an elephant on LSD, and so they moved him over to UCLA, and that's where he ended his career. And actually, he goes over there right at the same time that Ted Kaczynski was over there. Now, I can't make any kind of direct link. It was just one of those things that I found. The years coincide, and Kaczynski had been part of these MKUltra experiments at Harvard, and then he leaves Harvard and he goes to UCLA right at the time that West is heading out his program over there. So that's just interesting. But
well, now they're being held, like Terry Nichols and the Unabomber, they're being held at the most secure federal prison, I think, in the system. Is that in Florence, Colorado?
Yes, sir, that's right.
And they don't allow visitation or communication at all, I don't think.
No, and I know, you know, even attorneys have been unable to depose Terry Nichols on videotape, and that's another Jesse Trinity case. And I'm not sure the status of Ted Kaczynski. I haven't kept up as much with him, but
I believe he's still there at that same prison, okay. And so is Terry Nichols.
Okay,
it seems
yeah.
like that's a place that they put them when they don't want them to communicate with the outside world, period.
Right.
See? And so it's just another mechanism to of cover up, it seems like to me, that because otherwise why wouldn't they let them talk to anyone? Terry Yakey, tell us about him. He was a really fine detective working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. What happened to him? What was his experience there? What happened to him?
He was an Oklahoma City Police Department. He was an officer in OKC PPD, and he was the first responder. I mean, the first one into the Murrah building after the bombing. And he witnessed basically that the bomb squad was already there. I mean, and within minutes of the blast, this was, you know. So he observed a lot of very strange goings on that morning, and we don't even know everything he observed because he was afraid to tell his family. He told them, I've seen things, and he became very scared. And then he was found, it was ruled a suicide, but the circumstances of his death would be impossible for a suicide. Somehow he dragged himself through the woods and strangled himself and shot himself and cut himself, and this was all supposedly a suicide. But he had been scared to the point where, you know, he had made very clear statements to his family that if something happens to me, I didn't do it to myself. This is because of what I saw on the day of the bombing. So we don't even actually know the extent of what Terrence Yakey saw.
Right. This thing has a long way to go to really getting down to the bottom of it. And now the focus of your next book is entitled what? Let me see here. Just a second. Coup, the 1995 Oklahoma City Bombing Plot.
That was the working title. I changed the title to Redacted to reflect how.
What is that now?
The title reflects the fact that all the information, a lot of pertinent information, is redacted when you try to get these documents. The reason there's two books is the first one really focuses deeply on Tim McVeigh from the time of his childhood up until the time of his time in prison. It deals with the plot, but it goes into some very strange circumstances surrounding his life, all of which are very suggestive of this conspiracy in the bombing and cover-up. But the second book actually is not focused on McVeigh. That goes into the nuts and bolts of the plot and what we've been able to piece together so far, 20 years later, as far as these domestic intelligence operations and how they coincide with this plot. And there's, all the same actors, same people. So that's
right. Do you have very much on? Now, do you have any very much on, is it Carol Howe, H-O-W-E? Was she at Elohim City?
She was one of the federal informants who was telling her handlers that there was a bomb coming on April 19th, 1995, in Oklahoma City.
Right.
Yes.
There was a survey that was conducted on several targets, possible targets.
That's right.
And somehow they settled on Oklahoma City. Would you think the reason might be because the children were there or what? What was the reason that Murrah building, you think, was targeted outside of?
I don't know. I know that some of the people that were involved with Ruby Ridge and Waco had offices there. That's one possible motive. But she's not the only one that said that there were several targets. We've got paper now to show many people seem to know this, that there were actually 3 to 4 targets in different cities, including Dallas and Denver. There was another one. I'm not popping in my head now, but there's corroborating information from other federal informants who said the exact same thing, named the exact same cities, and said that these were other targets. I really don't know why the Murrah building. All I know is, I guess, speculation I've heard.
Right, right. That we can't prove a lot of these things. You just have to. It's circumstantial, and there's evidence, but there's not direct evidence on some of these assertions and so forth.
Right, but after a while, they if you have mounds and mounds of circumstantial evidence, it definitely, makes a compelling case. But
It really impacted the American public. Psychologically, what would you say was the impact on the American public at large of Oklahoma City?
Well, it demonized anyone that might be called a patriot. It demonized gun ownership, Second Amendment advocates. It demonized anyone whose political views fell out of the norm at that time. So it really worked to demonize in the minds of the American public to the point where today, the name Tim McVeigh is just used as a shorthand for a right-wing bun nut militia, disgruntled veteran. So it cemented in the minds of the public this demon called the patriot.
Right. Some very good comments there, Dr. Painting. We've got about 4.5 minutes left here. What concluding remarks could you make? I know this is a short interview, 30 minutes or so, but what kind of concluding remarks would you make that maybe we skipped over or left out?
Well, it's such a complex long. I mean, it took years to write this. To write this first book, and in the end, I had to cut it almost in half, but it's so complex. It's very hard to encapsulate a lot of these things, but especially if you have any interest in Dr. West or McVeigh's military career, I really urge you to read, pick up a copy on Trine Day Publishing. They're coming out with it, to pick up a copy of the book, because there is so much to talk about. I feel like I explain it better in writing sometimes than I do, in a conversation, because it is so overwhelming. There are so many little strands and threads to this. One thing I think is very interesting, though, is that Tim McVeigh, for this like great soldier who had a perfect record, he has 72 visits to dentists and doctors. And that's not even the complete military medical record. And it really begs the question, was he the victim of some type of medical experimentation? Holland and I talked to men in his company, all of whom became extremely sick after their time in the Gulf War. But McVeigh's showing symptoms of what you would call Gulf War syndrome prior to even being deployed. Immediately after he starts to receive these vaccines and then he's going to the doctor at least once a week, sometimes more. And that is one of the very strange things that's just never talked about, with McVeigh.
Right. This is very, very intriguing. It has a lot of different things to research further, does it not? The archives in Austin, they were very much of help to you, were they not?
Absolutely, yeah. They absolutely were.
And what gleanings, what were some of the most important things you picked up there through those archives that stand out in your mind?
I think for me was discovering, after piecing together all of the military records dates, that stood out, but a lot of the private conversations that are recorded between McVeigh and his defense attorneys, that also becomes very important because he tells different stories at different times, and I'm able to trace and show how his story changed over time, at least publicly, and even to his attorneys. I mean, to his very first attorneys, he claimed that he had been inducted into this counterintelligence operation, and then he quickly dropped that story, but that was the very first thing he told his very first attorneys, who then recused themselves. They quit the case. They told Stephen Jones, "When you know what we know, you're never going to think the same way about your country again."
Well, even some of those attorneys, you know, the ones out of Dallas, got things have gotten back to me that they really had a wake up themselves from their interaction with the government on that particular case.
Oh, yeah.
And some of those have really had a surprising reaction to the legal system itself as being very, very corrupt and very difficult to work with and very difficult to get down to the truth or get a legitimate decision. That's what the conclusion of some of my feedback.
Certainly.
Okay?
Yes. And there's new information now that Jesse Trinity has to show that there are actually plans, the people planted in that defense team. So, you know, for what that's worth.
You've got to keep an open mind and keep digging, and that's what you're
Absolutely.
Doing, Dr. Wendy Painting. And thank you for being with us this evening. We certainly did enjoy our conversation, and keep on going. You're doing a great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Okay. Good night. Thank you so very much, Dr. Wendy Painting. That book on Oklahoma is going to make a difference. She's working on a further book that's going to be out this fall, I think published by Trine Day out of Oregon there. And it's a really fine publishing company. We wish you all the luck in the world, Dr. Wendy Painting, on your next book. But she came down here, as she related during our interview earlier, a few minutes ago, that she spent weeks after weeks in researching in the archives here at the University of Texas. So what we didn't get into, we got into her book, but some of the aspects of what has been going on, I think, need to be expanded on. She couldn't stay with me but for about 30 minutes, so we're going to flesh out a little bit of background here about what went on over a number of years. I mean, this just didn't spring up, you know, all of a sudden, and all of this, militia movements and all this, and people out there protesting about, you know, what was going on. This just didn't happen overnight because, you know, with no cause behind it. Randy Weaver, the Ruby Ridge incident out in Idaho. The it started about August 22nd, 1992, and it lasted about 10 days. But there was he was set up. Randy Weaver was set up with by an ATF agent out there, and so as a result, they all went in there. This is what I'm trying to do here is give you a little history about what's been going on. The feds have been becoming very, very aggressive in their stance and some of their actions and so forth. And especially from Randy Weaver incident forward, and then you got the 9/11 in there. But anyway, we're going to try to give you a little bit of an insight on how some of this worked. There was a 10-day standoff out in Randy Weaver's place, and his son was killed, and there was an agent killed. And so they went in there and then shot his wife between the eyes, holding a little baby standing at the front door. I mean, it was just a terrible incident, but very aggressive. A Japanese FBI sniper is the one that pulled the trigger on Randy Weaver's wife. Well, they sentenced him to prison, and then he sued the federal government and finally got $3 million and so forth. But the money, of course, was a poor substitute for losing his wife and his little baby. But anyway, starting with that was in 92, around August in 1992. And what followed after that was the 93 incident up in Waco. Okay, so you had the Waco that occurred just months after, about 6 months after or so. And there you had the Branch Davidians. They went in the end of February for 50-something days and stood off, and nearly 100 people were killed, and there were 4 agents. This last Sunday, the Branch Davidians, some of the survivors, had a memorial inside the church on the Branch Davidian property there just east of Waco. And they named all of those victims that had died, you know, during the standoff and so forth. And Clive Doyle is a surviving member of the Branch Davidian group, religious group. And he got up there and named them all. And also, what they never forget is those agents that perished also. There were four ATF agents that died in that incident in Waco, and that occurred on the final burn down of the complex occurred on April 19th, 1993. So that was the second major incident, and the feds were behind that also. They're very aggressive. They came in with a flare, forward-looking infrared plane, surveilling overhead at 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And then there's evidence there that there were machine guns fired from the rear of the complex on the day of the fire. And also, what's not really known is they were using CS gas, which is very caustic gas, and it's recommended not to be used inside because it's lethal. And then what they did was they mixed that in with a paint thinner and sprayed it into the complex. And they, knowing full well that there were candles, open flames in there, and then all of a sudden you had a conflagration. And phosgene gas is a result of CS gas burning. And that's basically, there was poisonous gas everywhere in there, and that drove out the Branch Davidians, who had been standing off for 50-something days. There was a standoff there, and they wouldn't come out. And also, on this hour, too, I'm going to play you some personal experience and witness that Clive Doyle had at a memorial about 2 years ago in Waco. He related from the podium what happened, you know, minute by minute. And we're going to play that for you during the second hour and to give you a good idea of what really went on up there. But what happened after that was about a year later. What this caused was this very aggressive federal government against groups that had not committed felonies or anything. They went in and they started attacking them, and so this gave rise to a very fearful public out here that they said, "Man, we'd better get armed. We better organize militias and so forth," and do something about this. And so what happened was you had a rise of militia organizations all over the country. We attended, we were holding a group meeting every Monday night here in Austin, Texas, since 1990 onward, every Monday night. And so these incidents occurred while we were holding those meetings. And so we were disseminating information and talking about all of what was going on a real-time basis. So we were beginning to really become fearful ourselves. A year after the Branch Davidian burned down in Waco, we held a rally in front of the Alamo, in Alamo Plaza, on April 19, 1994. Jack McLam had written a booklet entitled A Vampire 2000, and he set out the military organization of this country. He was one of the most decorated, if not the most decorated, Arizona law enforcement people ever. He's passed away now, but Jack McLam was a fine person. But anyway, he published this booklet, and we handed it out, two or 300 of those, to people there at that rally. And the Texas militia rallied at that time, and I believe it was noted that this was the first Texas militia rally in 88 years in Texas. So we were trying to organize and trying to take back some of our freedoms and liberties because of a very aggressive federal government, and especially because of the Randy Weaver attack at Ruby Ridge, and then also followed by the Waco. Now Bill and Hillary were in the White House during the Waco, and today, if you bring that up to her when she's out on the campaign trail, I think that would be a good question to ask her. Janet Reno at the time was asked, and it was revealed by her answers that she did not know what CS gas was. And in Waco, they used this CS gas, and it was very, very lethal when it started burning. So anyway, you had Randy Weaver in 92, August of 92, followed by the Branch Davidian burn down in April 19th of 1993, and then followed by a rally. And a rallying, the next 2 years, militia movements grew exponentially. And then you had Oklahoma on April 19th, 1995. And basically what that did was Bill Clinton being president, they morphed it and flexed it into an attack on the militia movement nationwide, and it virtually cut the legs out from under a very growing and prosperous militia movement at that time. And I believe McVeigh was tied to the Michigan militia in a very obtuse way, but not any real proof there. And in fact, he had been up there to a meeting or something, and they had really not run him off, but they did not welcome him at the time. We just spoke earlier with Wendy Painting, and she says that there's evidence there that McVeigh was working as a covert agent for the federal government. He told his sister. There was other evidence and so forth. There's Bill Bean that said that that he had a video of him coming out of an APC up at some fort that specialized in a demolition and so forth. Anyway, this is very, very aggressive government that has evolved. And in that very, very aggressive state, they didn't really get aggressive until later. Now, what we've got to understand here is that we're looking at a militarization, and I think Alex Jones has followed this along with Mike Hansen. They actually trailblazed in this area of going out with their cameras and doing videotaping, videography of these operations in cities where they would go in and attack buildings and so forth along a terrorist theme. Now, what has since transpired is something that is even more vicious and more evilly, with more evil intent. And that's 9/11. There's evidence today coming out of ae911truth.org, which is Richard Gage's group out there, and then Judy Wood. I attended a few months ago a speech down at Blinn College by Judy Wood, and Judy Wood, in my opinion, seems to have the answer on 9/11. She's closer to actually what happened there in 9/11. But 9/11, by many people today, is believed to have been a false flag operation on a gigantic basis. Even today, when you speak to people about it in those terms, they're going to say, oh, no, that's not right. And, you might even hear the word nutcase and conspiratorial and all this other stuff. Eric Samuelson, when we were meeting here in Austin every Monday night, he coined the term conspiracy scholars. And I think that's what many of the people like Alex and others have become. There are people that have delved into this now on a very deep basis and a very, very insightful basis. You have doctors like Dr. Wendy Painting, and you have a lot. I can't even tell you all of the people that have written books on different aspects of this militarization of the police. Just one little aspect of this is that when I went out along with two colleagues, Randall Mock and Farrell Montgomery, we went out to do the Paul Festival and in Tampa, Florida. And we got in there driving into the Florida State Fairgrounds, and we saw a little sign off to the right. It said Leo Parking. It had three capital letters, L-E-O, and it had a parking this way with an arrow, you know. We didn't know what that Leo meant, you know. So we went ahead and went to the gate and got cleared through security onto the fairgrounds. And then we came up to a T. Well, I made the wrong decision. I said, well, I think it's to the right, but it actually wasn't the right turn. We made a right turn and went down to where Leo was. And what we found there, we looked off to our right at this roadblock, to the right of the roadblock, and we saw several acres, 2 or 3 football fields at least, of cars parked out there. It's 400 or 500 police cars of all jurisdictions. I mean, we saw constables' cars and sheriff's cars and police cars and so forth and so on. And they were parked all over there, and they were holding a convention or a symposium, actually a symposium. And it was revolving around this LEO idea. And what LEO stands for is Law Enforcement Online. So what they can't do by breaking through and overturning the jurisdiction problem that they have, they're trying to network using the Internet to overcome that jurisdiction prohibition, see. Now, with that taken there, the reason why it has been accelerated and this militarization, and when I say militarization of the police and so forth and a martial law type of trend, I'm talking about force, the use of force. And the use of force is one of the main characteristics of a police state or a system of fascism. See, the overtones of what's happening today in America, Peikoff wrote a book called Ominous Parallels. He was a inheritor of the one of the heirs to objectivism, to Ayn Rand's objectivism. And in that book, Ominous Parallels, he wrote about the parallels of Nazi Germany and parallels with certain things that were happening in this country in the 60s. And then it's very, very ominous when he said ominous parallels. It was ominous, and it was obvious that we've got parallels to what's going on now compared to what happened in Nazi Germany. And when you start looking into the history, World War II, as the Nazis that were brought out of Nazi Germany, intentionally brought out and were given shelter and so forth, the Catholic Church did their part also. But they brought them to Argentina, they brought them to other South American countries, and they brought a number of those scientists that they could draw upon and brain pick them, you know, mind pick their brains. And trying to get all this research knowledge out in mind control and other disciplines that they had developed during World War II in some of those Holocaust camps. So along comes on 9/11 a great attack. This attack is monstrous and is being presented to the American public as an Arab jihadist attack, a Muslim radical that hates America attack on America. And all of a sudden, we have two buildings that fall, and then a third one later on that afternoon, which was Building 7. The only buildings that fell totally there, and there were some damaged around the periphery, were World Trade Center buildings, 1 through 7. And some of those, 1 and 2, fell completely. And 7 was complete loss, also fell completely, collapsed into its own footprint. The other buildings were totally 80% or more, and some were a little bit, you know, left after that, more than that. But basically, we had two of the tallest buildings in the country all of a sudden disappear. That's why Judy Wood's proposition and theory is going to prove more to be right than anyone else, even though she's been maligned with all kinds of propaganda and attacks on her good name. So Judy Wood is a fine person, and she stands for the truth, and I agree with her position at this time and her theory. So along comes 9/11, this great tragic attack on America. But this was the most treacherous, treasonous act ever committed against this country. And that's why it was such a dastardly deed, so to speak, using some words from Roosevelt after the Pearl Harbor. And then the Pearl Harbor thing, after that happened, it helped attract and recruit all kinds of hundreds of thousands of men into the service to go get those dirty Japs, see? They had to, and boy, they did too. They recruited those people in. And 9/11 has done a similar thing in galvanizing the American opinion into being anti-Muslim and so forth. and to go over there and to promulgate an attack on Afghanistan and then later into Iraq. These deeds today, the American public is being just led around. The reason why the American public is not wakeful in this area is because over the years, over the decades, and especially since the turn of the century, we've had a system that's developed. And you could say that money itself is part of the equation. And the way it works is that if you have a true system of capitalism, and where people can borrow money freely, and those that have the best goals and so forth can borrow it and get it and prosper and back, and to provide services, products and services to their fellow men and their public. That is the efficiency of capitalism. But when you had the 1913 Federal Reserve System created, where you had a monopoly of money creation, then that was the beginning of the end for the country. Because what happened was the good old boys and the insiders and the elitists started just making, creating money for themselves and buying up the rest of the country. That's why you see public-private partnerships as a major, major idea at the Bilderberg meetings and at the World Economic Forum. They keep pushing that because they have the money now through their own creation and their own prospering of their own corporation to buy up the infrastructure of the world. And that's basically what they're out to do now. They want to own everything and relegate us to a system of slavery. They're building a giant plantation. It's a world plantation. But it's not along the lines of color or race. It's everyone is being subjugated to slavery. But it's a very, very sophisticated system. And that's why it's very difficult to see. Well, when I get back to how did this really happen, it happened over a number of decades where you had the buildup of propaganda and ideas, and then many of your higher schools of learning, because in the last couple of decades, you've seen the corporate move into your universities on a large scale. And when you had all this money for research and everything and to fund this and to fund that and this foundation and that foundation, then many of your universities now are dominated by the corporations. And so that money that they put out on foundations and so is one of the primary techniques and ways that they control the academicians. Now, the academicians are being funded, of course, and controlled in that way. But you have to couple that not only with the money, but with ideas. And that's what 9/11 did. Not only are they using money to mesmerize and control people, but they're using these ideas about 9/11 and this great attack on America. See, and when you combine those two together, you've got a dominating influence on the population at large. And that's what we're under now. Now, let's get back to why people can't see this. Why people can't see it is that the proposition that this was a false flag operation is preposterous to start with. And that's why many people just write it off and they're saying, oh, those nuts, they're crazy to think that. And what I hear also is that our people wouldn't do that against our own country. Our leaders wouldn't do that. Well, yes, they would do that. Because it's hard to imagine a leadership, an elite group, that is this evil. When you start looking at and taking apart the pedophile dynamic, the psychopathic dynamic, the sociopathic dynamic, and you couple that with money and so forth, you begin to awaken to the dynamics on a synergistic basis of how this works. And that's basically what we're talking about, is that we're talking about a social synergy that has evolved with a monopolistic system of money finance, coupled with an idea dominance through your universities. And what we've done at the university level is we're producing widgets, you could describe as secular humanist widgets. They were just spitting them out and handing them degrees. I had occasion to go down a few years ago and witness a friend of mine's son graduating. And an hour and 20 minutes later, that graduation was over. And that's a major university in Texas. There was this short commencement speech. They handed out all these. Boy, they had it timed perfect, didn't they? About an hour and 30 minutes. And so the manufacturing of these minds into a secular humanist, way is continuing. So when you have the secular, when you say secular, you mean non-religious, see? So when you have a secular humanist type person coming out of the universities, they thumb their nose at any religions and any God above them. No. That's just a bunch of hogwash to them, because what they've been convinced is that thinking that man has the answers because of all this so-called education, then that's all they have to possess. They don't have to humble themselves or bend their knee to anyone or anything, call God or anything like that. And so as a result, because they do not bend their knee and they will not humble themselves, you've got this ego play that's happening also. So that's the problem. And the super egos and the really extreme egos end up without a conscience, acting out as psychopaths. And that's basically what we're up against at this time, is that we have a bunch of psychopaths that are ultra wealthy, and they're the elitist of the world, billionaires many times over, and their egos are just up there in the ionosphere, you could say. And they think themselves as gods. Now, when I approach people that are coming out of this secular humanist environment and conditioning, they say, that's it. You don't know that. No, you know, when I say men are trying to become God, they don't even like that, see, because they think that if you think enough, okay, and about something, you can set up a system. These people have been mesmerized into a system, a systematic way of thinking, that all you have to do is program it right and set up a system and you can right all these wrongs, see? So that's where the liberal left has gone wrong, is that they believe that they can set up a system of government and programs that can solve all of our ills. But that's not true. On the right side, you do have religious groups then that are becoming more cultic in their thinking than before. And in their cultic thinking, they've got all kinds of end times thinking and so forth that is way, way even outside of the written word. Even the scripture says no man knows the time and date, but they'll take it and they'll project and construct an end times thinking that is way, way far in advance of any scripture whatsoever. So both from the right, an extreme, you could say, view from the right like that. And also that right suffers because they can easily be cultivated into a very strong defense and militaristic funding basis. So their way of thinking is that, we believe in God and God is overall and we're going to have this end times and it's happening now, but we believe in a strong military, see. So, They're susceptible to being cultivated and into maintaining a very strong, high military spending basis, which actually the elites just continue to steal from. So there on then on the left you have a social and moral relativist view that's of all these secular humanists, where they're thinking that man is the answer. But so neither side is fully informed enough to understand and figure it out. So, and they can't figure it out because they're being deluded